the Book of Ruth. I'm looking at the Book of Ruth. The Book of Ruth is a short historical narrative. The Book of Ruth is a book that was either written by probably Samuel or Solomon. It is a book that, because of its own internal structure, you know, it references the genealogy that has occurred in terms of the genealogy of King David. And so it has to have been written significantly after the events themselves, because it talks about those things as having been completed. And so the end of the book has a genealogy that goes up to King David. So it's either during the reign of David or after the reign of David. So that means we're looking at this having been written somewhere between 1,010 years before Christ, or maybe 970 years before Christ. There's about a 40-year window that we're looking at likely having this be written. Now, the time that the book takes place in is a time that is in the book of Judges between about Judges 3 and Judges 5. And so there's a period where we see basically Deborah, who is a female judge, she has a song that describes kind of the environment in which this book would be occurring in. And that song of Deborah is a valuable thing for us to take a look at. The period is, we're looking at, there's a judge named Ehud, and this judge is famous for having committed political assassination, righteously. And so we'll read that story. It's a memorable story. And then Deborah is memorable for having told a man, Barak or Baruch, I can never quite remember. We'll see that in the text too. She tells him to not take her as a female judge with him to the battle. And if he does, God will dishonor that by having a woman steal his glory. And so their great enemy that they end up overcoming by the power of God in battle, the man who leads the army does not get the honor of finishing off the enemy. And instead, a servant girl puts a tent peg through his head and defeats him. And so those are the two famous events that kind of surround this. And so we're looking at a period that's there. The events in the book go over about a 10-year period. And what we're going to see is the book is structured in such a way that it basically gives us the major theme in how it begins and how it ends. And the beginning of the book has Naomi being humbled, which is the title for today's sermon, and at the end it has her being exalted. And so this process here is a way of showing the way that God deals with us in terms of discipline and the way that he uses affliction for our good. And so we see Naomi here in her humbling at the beginning. Now, there are a number of ideas that get dealt with in the book. It deals with the politics of the time, preparedness and survival and community in terms of that. The very beginning is basically the family as preppers and survivalists selling all their stuff and leaving Israel to get out of a zone of famine and trying to go to a place where they likely have some sort of business connections, but they're in the absence of the covenant community. And so not planning for the covenant community, but instead focusing on those business connections is something that is a warning to us to not put money before covenant community. The next thing that we see is we also see lots of discussion of food and wealth and generosity, work and business and the division of labor. Those are all throughout. And how much of that relates to ordinary life? You know, life is dominated by work. The Bible does not fancifully ignore that. One of the interesting things about a lot of books that are attempting to be philosophical is they ignore, to some extent, the way in which work is dominant in life. And they ignore trying to make work integrate well. And so you end up with this sort of oddness about work in a lot of philosophies. The Bible deals with work as integral to life and dominant. And that, in fact, work is the way that we manifest the reign of Christ in the earth, work is the way we exercise dominion. And so the idea of joyful work, good work, Christian labor is important and key. The book deals with relationships, friendships, courtship, engagement, marriage, and all of these things are looked at in light of the providence of God. And so I want to emphasize the fact that all of these things have their ups and downs. And so you'll see at the top of major themes and topics, this book goes through the humiliation and exaltation of Naomi, and it helps us to see that joy comes from right focus, not from right circumstances. Joy comes from right focus, not from right circumstances. We can seek to improve our circumstances, but you can have great circumstances and be miserable. Or you can have terrible circumstances and be joyful. Joy comes from right focus. And the key focus is the focus on the glory of God, the doxological focus. And so we're going to see that in the book as well. Now, there are certain things you need to know as background that if you don't understand them, the book kind of doesn't make any sense. So one of these ideas is the doctrine of the Levirate marriage. So open your Bible to Deuteronomy chapter 25. Now, God, while you're turning, I'll explain something. Deuteronomy 25. God establishes laws about marriage in the Mosaic Law. And it says, you know, don't marry close kin. It lists out who that is. Gives us a principle of degrees, how far they have to be out. It also establishes that you don't marry people based upon how close they are in marriage relationships, so in-laws, and the idea of how close of an in-law is not marriageable. So Deuteronomy 25 establishes an exception, and the exception is not a permanent exception, it's a temporary exception in Israel based upon the idea of covenant succession, of the ownership of land, and the preservation of names in genealogy. And we're going to see how important that is, because this line, through this idea of the Levirate marriage, okay, this is the line that leads to David and that ultimately leads to Christ. And so God uses that to show how he preserves lines and how he accomplishes his purpose. So, the Levirate marriage. Deuteronomy chapter 25, verse 5. So again, this is a duty that existed at this time, in the Old Testament. It is not a continuing duty, it's a ceremonial law. If brothers dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son. Now, think about those conditions. Dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son. If brothers dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside of the family. Her husband's brother shall go into her, take her as his wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. Let me pause there. We're about to read about how you can say no. The woman would also have the right to say no, and saying no would be on grounds that would be, this person is not fit to be married to. Okay? So there could be character objections, there could be reasons why you would say no. And so the story has this in it, and it has someone saying no. Okay? So we need to consider that. Verse 6. And it shall be that the firstborn son which she bears will succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. But if the man does not want to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to raise up a name to his brother in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him. But if he stands firm and says, I do not want to take her, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the presence of the elders, remove his sandal from his foot, spit in his face, and answer, and say, so shall it be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel, the house of him who had his sandal removed. Now, some of that seems to probably lose its sting in modern America, right? The house of him who had his sandal removed. The effect would be, this is a guy who can't be trusted to keep his agreements. The giving of the sandal is a sort of contractual exchange. And now he's got nothing to give for the contractual exchange. So here's a guy who doesn't do his duty. So that's the effect. Obviously, being spat on in the face is also something I think we can relate to, especially being done in public. So that's the situation. If you have an obligation and don't take it, this is the kind of penalty, this is the shame penalty that can come. Is in the public records, you're known as a non-sandal wearer, and you've been spat on in the face in the gates, which is like the public courthouse, except everybody's watching. It's like public court on court TV. Okay, so that's what we're talking about. So levirate marriage. A levirate marriage. The other thing you need to know about is the land redemption principles that exist that relate to the idea of a kinsman redeemer. Okay, so a kinsman redeemer, also known as a goel in Hebrew, and I'm just going to explain this a little bit, and I'll look at the land element because that's key to the story. There's four elements of what a kinsman redeemer does, but the one that's key to the story is related to land. Okay, so a kinsman redeemer, a goel, he has three qualifications. He has to be related by blood, he has to be willing to redeem, and he has to be able to redeem. So redeeming means buying, right? So what are the scenarios that someone might have to buy something to have a duty? Well, one would be in the case of avenging murder. So if somebody murders a family member and there is not sufficient civil order for that to be dealt with by the magistrate, there's this devolution of authority for vengeance to the kinsman redeemer. And so feuding is often points to this as sort of the principle. The problem is feuding never ends, right? It's just a constant sort of duel or assassinating that occurs without any sort of resolution in justice. The murder has to have a process of appeal. And so in Israel, you had what are called the cities of refuge, where you could go and a kinsman redeemer could not come and kill you. But instead, there had to be a trial. And so the idea here is, and this is, I think, valuable for a modern American law. In modern American law, in order to argue that you killed a person in self-defense, you have to confess to killing them. So you plead the fifth, you don't get to make an argument that I did this in self-defense. And so in the Bible, the idea here is, if you want to be able to say I killed this guy in self-defense, or I want to admit that it was done accidentally but not negligently, you run to the city where there is a court of appeal, and you confess that you killed this person, but that it wasn't wrong. And so that removes a process of jurisprudence of having to prove that the person killed somebody. Instead, it incentivizes confessing that you killed somebody when you didn't murder them. So the kinsman redeemer is able to go hunt you down, except when you're in a place waiting for the trial, for this court of appeal, a higher court to take it on. And that demonstrates the idea of using higher courts for more difficult cases as well as original courts. So I like jurisprudence. You have to tolerate me unless you remove me from office so you get to hear about jurisprudence. Now, in addition to that, the kinsman redeemer, if a family member was poor, had debts, and as a result had to be sold into slavery to pay their debts, the kinsman redeemer had the obligation to buy that person out of slavery and give them their freedom back. In addition to that, if someone was so poor that they had to essentially sell their house off, and it was the family farm, the kinsman redeemer had the obligation to help them to buy it back. And lastly, marrying the childless widow of a deceased relative, the kinsman redeemer has this obligation for the levirate marriage. So those two ideas interrelate. These things are key to understanding the book of Ruth. So let's look at the part relating to the redeeming of the property. Okay, so we look at the levirate marriage already. Let's look at the redeeming of property. Go to Leviticus 25. So if you're at Deuteronomy, go to the left two books. So Leviticus 25, we're looking at verses 23 through 34. Leviticus 25, verse 23. The land shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine. Okay, this is talking about the promised land in particular, and the giving of land, and we're going to see this doesn't apply to all land. This is only the land that was given out to the tribes as an inheritance. Okay, this is only the land given out to the tribes as an inheritance. And one of the interesting things we're going to see here is it does not apply to property in cities. It does not apply to property in cities. And so land outside of the promised land, land in cities, there would have been nothing about this. This is only the tribal inheritance land that was dished out at God's decree. And not just a decree isn't like he controls everything decree. I mean, God saying, you will do this. And then they're using lots to divide up the land. That land was divided up by God with a very particular purpose, and that is what has to be maintained. So the land shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, for you are strangers and sojourners with me. And in all the land of your possession you shall grant redemption of the land. What's redemption of the land? That's what the explanation is. Verse 25, if one of your brethren becomes poor and has sold some of his possession, and if his redeeming relative comes to redeem it, that he may redeem what his brother sold. Or if the man has no one to redeem it, but he himself becomes able to redeem it, then let him count the years since its sale and restore the remainder to the man to whom he sold it, that he may return to his possession. What does this mean about the years? This land that was impacted by this decree, by this command of God, is also land that every Jubilee, every 50 years, would have been restored to the original line that owned it. So even if there's no redeemer who can pay it back, every sale of land that meets this description is really just a 50-year lease at maximum. And what you do is you value the price based upon the number of years until the next Jubilee, because that's the maximum lease length. And then you're going to put a time discount on that price, right? You go, what's the yield of the land? Here's a time discount, and then you're also going to have some risk in there, right? And so the sale price of that land is going to be the time remaining on the list on the lease until Jubilee, minus some time value, minus a risk value, and that's how the market would consider the value of the land. Now, verse 28. But if he is not able to have it restored to him, then what was sold shall remain in the hand of him who bought it until the year of Jubilee. And in the Jubilee, it shall be released, and he shall return to his possession. If a man sells a house in a walled city, then he may redeem it within a whole year after it is sold. Within a full year, he may redeem it. But if it is not redeemed within the space of a full year, then the house in the walled city shall belong permanently to him who bought it. Throughout his generations, it shall not be released in the Jubilee. However, the houses of villages which have no wall around them shall be counted as the fields of the country. They may be redeemed, and they shall be released in the Jubilee. Okay, so this idea of villages without walls, This is called village life. We're going to see Deborah refer to village life. And the cities without walls, the villages without walls, Deborah says village life ceased. Things were so dangerous in Israel that nobody lived outside of walled cities. So that's the level of marauding danger that there was. Okay, so this idea of the unwalled village life ceased. Verse 32, nevertheless, the cities of the Levites and the houses of the cities of their possession Levites may redeem at any time. That's because why? What's the relationship there? Because the Levites didn't get any farmland. Their only possession was the city of the Levites. So that is their patrimony. That is their that is their inheritance that they've received from the Lord. And if a man purchases a house from the Levites, then the house that was sold in the city of his possession shall be released in the Jubilee. For the houses in the cities of the Levites are their possession among the children of Israel. But the field of the common land of their cities may not be sold, for it is their perpetual possession. Okay, the common land would be a common. You ever heard of commons? Like a city park. Imagine you've got a field that's designed to allow anybody's animals to be in, so that you have a, where can I put my animals while I'm here in the town or whatever, and that's the commons, right? And that's where the tragedy of the commons comes from, because you've got common ground for grazing or common ground for growing. Everybody's incentivized to just take from it and not to care for it and to overuse it, right? So the tragedy of the commons. So commons of a town, they could not be sold if they were Levite commons. Okay, so those are the kind of background elements to the structure of law that gives the basis for the story. The other thing that I want to point out here that we're going to see, the story, the work that is focused on that Ruth does throughout the book is gleaning. Okay, gleaning. So go to Leviticus again. I'm sorry. Shouldn't have had you close Leviticus. I shouldn't have closed Leviticus. All right, Leviticus 19. The idea of gleaning is basically, how do you make it so that poor people have something that they can eat without making them lazy? It's a difficult problem. You just hand people stuff. It encourages laziness, right? So, gleaning. What is gleaning? Okay, so Leviticus 19, verses 9 and 10. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest. Okay, so you leave some of the corners of your field and you don't cut them because they're able to be picked. And then when you're cutting stuff down, there's going to be things that fall and you don't go back and pick all that up. And that way, there is unrefined goods that people can come and do work, so they have to harvest themselves. And then they have to deal with threshing themselves and preparing the food themselves. And so this is charity that requires work. Puritans have been mocked historically, mainly by Charles Dickens, for workhouses. Okay, Scrooge famously says, around Christmas no less, you know, are there no workhouses? When he's asked about somebody who needs some sort of help. Are there no workhouses? You know, modern, you know, Scrooges drive by people who are on the side of the road and they say, get a job. Heartless, right? It's heartless to teach people to not do work. It's heartless to teach people to not do work. The verse 10 continues, and you shall not glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather every grape of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the stranger. I am Yahweh, your God. I am the Lord, your God. Remember those all cap L-O-R-D is the covenant name of God. Now, go to Leviticus 23. Leviticus 23, verse 22. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field when you reap, nor shall you gather any gleaning from your harvest. You shall leave them for the poor and for the stranger. I am the Lord your God. Now, one of the things people complain about when they complain about people who move to a country, right? You go, if we have welfare, then it's going to attract people to come here, take the handouts, and then just be a leech on society. The welfare system for strangers, for aliens in Israel, was let them, like the poor, deal with harvesting and collecting gleanings And so it's not handing out. It's allowing them to do some work and to get the crumbs from the table, so to speak, by their own work. And so this prevents people from just coming, because you know what's a lot easier than gleaning? Like any paid job ever. Here's what gleaning is. Gleaning is collecting food by bending down to the ground and collecting that like leftover stuff from harvesting, and you're picking it up and you got to put it into a bag. I want you to imagine trying to collect the remnants of a harvest and then finding the pieces of grain left over in it without capital equipment, without just collecting that yourself, and then you having to go through your threshing plan, right? You have to thresh that. You have to separate the wheat and chaff, okay? Do you think it's more efficient to do this kind of hand picking of the gleanings up off of the ground afterward and putting it into a bag and then threshing it yourself? Or do you think a wage-earning job serving on someone else's land would help you to live more comfortably? So the idea of making the poor comfortable in their poverty, it's wicked because it discourages dominion. It discourages them from productivity. It discourages them from the joy of eating the fruit of their own labors and being able to build up an inheritance to pass on. And so this system is designed to allow the poor to never be destitute to the point of starvation, while at the same time making being poor awful. Paul says, if you don't work, you don't eat. This is the system for making sure that you have to work. So that is the system of helping to care for the poor. Now, you could, of course, be generous, and we will see generosity in this. But generosity does not take the form of preventing somebody from having to work. All right, that's not generosity. That is setting somebody up for destruction. Now, those are the big topics and ideas. We look at this. We look at this situation. Go to page 2. And I want you to understand, when we look at the beginning of the book of Ruth, we're going to see a few things get pointed out, and I'm going to point out these things in the chapter. So we're actually going to start reading. Let's look at Ruth chapter 1. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech. The name of his wife was Naomi, which, by the way, means pleasantness. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to the country of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left, and her two sons. Now they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other, Ruth. And they dwelt there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died. So the woman survived her two sons and her husband. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law, that she might return from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread. Remember earlier, verse 1, there's a famine, and now the Lord's visiting and giving bread. Therefore, verse 7, therefore she went out from the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with them. And they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go, return each to her mother's house. Go, return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you, as you've dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband. So the Naomi here is telling Orpah and Ruth to go back to their parents' homes and is asking for blessing on them that they would find husbands and enjoy those households. So she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "Surely we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Turn back, my daughters, go, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, if I should have a husband tonight and should also bear sons, would you wait for them till they grow, till they were grown? Would you restrain yourselves from having husbands? No, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And she said, "Look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there will I be buried. The Lord do so much to me and more also, if anything but death parts you and me." When she saw that she was determined to go with her, she stopped speaking to her. Now the two of them went until they came to Bethlehem. And it happened, when they had come to Bethlehem, that all the city was excited because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" But she said to them, "Do not call me Naomi," which means pleasantness. It could also mean sweetness. "Call me Mara," which means bitterness. "For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has testified against me, and the Almighty has afflicted me?" That word for Almighty right there is the famous name of God, Shaddai. So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab. Now they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. So we end the chapter that at the beginning of barley harvest, it's a sign of hope, right? The Lord has appeared to his people, visited them, and brought them food. And they're at the beginning of barley harvest. And so the idea that there's food coming into the land. Now the name Bethlehem means house of bread. Beth means house. And Lehem. And so this idea that it's a house of bread is supposed to be ironic in the beginning, right? Because they're fleeing because there's a famine. They're fleeing the house of bread because there's no bread there. And so this famine, they leave. And the famine is caused in the season of time in Israel when Deborah is talking. So I am not going to have time to read the whole passage that I would like to, but the book of Judges, which is right before the book of Ruth, if you turn back with me to chapter 5, there's a small portion of the Song of Deborah which we should read. So chapter 5, verse 1. Then Deborah and Barak, not Baruch, Barak. Then Deborah and Barak, the son of Abinoam, sang on that day, saying, when the leaders led in Israel, when the people willingly offer themselves, bless the Lord. Hear, O kings, give ear, O princes. I, even I, will sing to the Lord. I will sing praise to the Lord God of Israel. Lord, when you went out from Seir, when you marched from the field of Edom, the earth trembled, and the heavens poured the clouds. So the heavens poured, the clouds also poured water. The mountains gushed before the Lord, this Sinai before the Lord God of Israel. In the days of Shamgar, son of Anath, in the days of Jael, the highways were deserted. These are the days leading up to the battle. They just had victory, okay? The highways were deserted. Why would highways be deserted? Highways are deserted either when there's no trade because there's poverty, or when there are bandits that stop people from traveling without being attacked. Bandits that are organized, that are essentially a military force, used to be referred to often as brigands. And so brigandage and armies that come in and actually bivouac, which is to live off the land by taking everything from the local population, those bivouacking armies and brigandage units would be things that would make it so that the highways are deserted. Highways are absolutely essential for centralized rule, for communication and for taxation, customs, the movement of armies, the movement of messages. So when the highways are deserted, the central authority has collapsed. So the tribal confederation, the covenanted tribal structure of the 12 tribes of Israel, we see here there has been a total collapse of the unified defensive covenant. They are obligated to defend each other, and this thing is shattered. Now, then it says, the highways were deserted, and travelers walked along the byways. The highways were deserted, and the travelers walked along the byways. So if they had to move, they went through places where they could hide. So that shows us that this isn't that there's nothing to move. The problem is the brigands. The problem is the armies. So when they went on the local roads that only the locals knew about to hide from the people who didn't know the land as well. So then, verse 7, village life ceased. It ceased in Israel. Until I, Deborah, arose a mother in Israel. They chose new gods. Then there was war in the gates. Okay, so there's this village life ceased. The marauding, the ravaging and pillaging, right, the awful wickedness that's occurring makes it so people go, it's not worth staying where the farms are. And so there's famine. And when there's famine and you're not farming, there's not much food. So the decision here is it's better to stay in the walled cities in the midst of famine than to go into the villages and seek to farm. This is how bad things are. Now, then it says, so Deborah is saying here that she, as a mother in Israel, arose to lead. No man did it. Deborah has to. And she's not condemned. She stands in the gap because of the total failure of the men. They chose new gods, and then there was war in the gates of the public place, right? So because there's new gods, there's not a receiving of the true God, the Ancient of Days, but the adopting of these new gods, there's war in the gates. And this war is pathetic. There's not a shield or a spear among 40,000 men in Israel. So you take a random cluster of 40,000 men in Israel, and they don't have a shield and a spear between the lot of them. So what does that mean? What's happened? Their oppressors have imposed a weapons ban on them. Their oppressors have imposed a weapons ban on them. We see that also during the time of Saul, when Jonathan and his armor bearer and Saul are the only guys that have swords because the Philistines have said no blacksmiths are allowed to be in Israel, no gun manufacturers, and we're not going to allow you to have even the things that you could make swords with. In fact, you have to go to a Philistine blacksmith to get your plowshares and pruning hooks sharpened. So these are the examples of weapons control in the Bible, is oppressors. My heart is with the rulers of Israel who offered themselves willingly with the people. Bless the Lord. Speak, you who ride on white donkeys, who sit in judges' attire, and who walk along the road, far from the noise of the archers, among the watering places. There they shall recount the righteous acts of the Lord, the righteous acts for his villagers in Israel. Then the people of the Lord shall go down to the gates. So the idea here is, there are some rulers who had valor, who were willing to go to battle, and they were willing to go with the villagers for the cause of the villagers, to see their land redeemed, not from some Israelite who bought it, but from these foreigners who were stopping them from being able to use their farms. And that redemption took them going out to battle and leading these men who didn't have weapons. So the men that are praised in this time of Deborah that overthrow the oppression, these are the men that are praised in that song. And they're the ones that there's this idea that now they return and they enjoy their wealth, and that there's a restoring of the order of things with the gates, with their proper rule. When they serve the villagers with their stations of authority, that results in their prosperity, is the idea. And so if you're a ruler and you want to see your own prosperity, you need to be dedicated, it says in the book of Ecclesiastes, you need to be dedicated to the cultivation of fields. And this is an example of that. You wage war to defend the property of the people under your authority. And that's dedication to the cultivation of fields. So we get introduced in the next chapter to Boaz. He's supposed to be basically a man of valor. So I want to posit to you that Boaz is one of these men willing to go with the villagers. At this point, he's a little bit old. His age is showing. And he's at the end of this time in this village life. So this is after the victory, Barak and Deborah. This is in the time of judges when there was no king. And people did what was right in their own eyes. And so we see here this kind of what's sometimes called republican virtue. The idea of the virtue of the men who have money in a republic is they have to be willing to give up their ease and their wealth and comfort and be willing to do public service, to go into battle, and to lead people who are unlanded, people who are without property. Because the landed people, the wealthy people, they're fine. You can figure it out. You can get away. It's fine. I can leave. I can travel. You can do what Naomi's husband did. We're going to sell the land. We're going to take the money. And we're going to leave. And what happens is she left full. Okay? Look at verse 21. I went out full. A lot of times you read this and you think, Naomi and her family, they're leaving because they're poor. No, they left. They were rich. They left with money, but they came back poor. The blessing of God is on those who are wealthy, who stay and take up the cause of the villager. And so the idea that this is biblical patriotism is the idea that you're responsible for defending the land. You're responsible for that, for the cause of the villager. So we'll come back, but we see here the leader of the household, Elimelech, was no Boaz. And so this results in Naomi being humbled because her husband would not do his duty, but instead fled the covenant community. So comments, questions, objections from the voting members? Mr. Cordova?
Two questions by Mr. Nye. He's asking, what biblical evidence is there to indicate that Ruth takes place during the time in Judges 3 to 5? Her and that's your biblical evidence.
Yeah, so that's the historical Jewish view, but also the use of the genealogies. You can compare the genealogies to the genealogies in Chronicles.
Okay. Second question, is there any part of the Jewish view that can or should be practiced today? For example, forgiveness of personal or corporate debts?
No, the Jubilee is not a civil law that has a general equity. It is a ceremonial law associated very specifically with the land and that property being given. The things that we need to apply are the desire in the diaconal service to support the poor of the congregation who are worthy poor, who are working poor, and who have who are showing themselves to be pursuing the knowledge of God. So there's a general obligation to pursue each other's well-being in the estate, in our estates, in our outward estates, but there's not a continuing obligation of the Jubilee year.
Okay.